And I want us to look at the real Jesus of the Bible. One of the things I think that strikes us out of this passage is that Jesus was not a very PC person. We live in a day and a society that increasingly, being politically correct is actually more important than being accurate and truthful. Whatever you do, you must not offend. And sometimes we can even get the mistaken view, I think, by reading the Bible that somehow Jesus fit into such a category, that he was a very PC person. Well, the truth of the matter was that Jesus was a very provocative person. Provocative not only in our day, but he was provocative in his own day. In fact, one of the things you see about the ministry of Jesus is that it constantly challenged the views that were normal at his own day. And I want to look at such a passage this morning. It's interesting, isn't it, that when you go through this passage, that you begin, if you go back a little further than Spencer read in verse 15, you begin with the crowds flocking to Jesus. After the feeding of the 5,000, we read this: Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew to a mountain by himself. He knew the crowds were coming. But notice with me, if you will, at the end of the chapter, verse 66, that from this time many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. It's interesting. Some people say, well, of course the Bible tells good stories about Jesus because the Bible was written by the followers of Jesus. Some years after his death, they started a movement, wanted to make him the center of their movement, and that's really what the Bible is. It's a collection of stories that primarily only shows the good bits of Jesus because that's what people wanted to see. But when you notice with me, actually, the exact opposite here. Friends, if you want to win a popularity contest, the last thing you do is publicly tell people how your main candidate drove people away. In fact, if you're really honest, no one would ever include this chapter in the Bible unless it was true. You just wouldn't do it if you wanted to actually win a hearing for Jesus. And yet, as we come this morning, we discover in this incident something of the reality of Christ. Now, I want to open up this passage because I think it is a fascinating passage, and primarily fascinating in this respect, that in this chapter, Jesus faces his critics. It's interesting, actually, that as we go through this chapter, you'll find that the critics are still the same today and asking exactly the same question. And here in this chapter, Jesus faces eyeball to eyeball his critics with the truth of who he is. So I want you to follow with me. We're going to look at that in three aspects, three problems that Jesus constantly causes wherever he is presented down through history and in the world. Number one, the problem of the person of Jesus. Number two, the problem of his diagnosis of our hearts. And number three, the problem of the promise of hope that Jesus sets out. So if you have your Bible open with me, and we'll follow down through that as we look, first of all, at the problem of the person of Jesus. Now, I don't know about you, but over the years, I have found many people who have been immensely impressed with the life and the teachings of Jesus. In fact, it's one of the things which I constantly find when I go in and talk to people, and you mention about the Lord Jesus, and they say, yes, I find that a very impressive life. But when you begin to open up to them something of the claims of Christ, then you begin to have a bit of an argument. I'm not so sure about that. But actually, what that highlights is the problem of the person of Jesus. Notice how that comes out in this passage before us here that we have this morning. On the one hand, Jesus is undeniably attractive. Notice again, verse 15 of John chapter 6. after the feeding of the 5,000, the crowds flocked to Jesus. Now, friends, there was a clever blog in the back of that crowd, with the feeding of the 5,000, and he knew that the number one problem there in Israel at that point was the occupation of the Romans. And what the Israelites, the Jews, needed supremely above everything else was someone to overthrow the Romans and to bring in a Jewish nation. Now, as he was contemplating this, suddenly he realized, Jesus is just the kind of general we want. I mean, if he's at the head of our armies, he can call down miracles, fires from heaven, and at the end of the battles, he can even raise the dead back to life. He can cure all those who are wounded. And if that's not good enough, we don't even have to have a supply train because he can feed us from a few loaves of fish. If we want a king, this is the kind of king we want. Jesus is an undeniably attractive person. Think about it for just a minute. His whole life, he went doing miracles, phenomenal miracles. The healing of the sick, the incurable. He was an individual of an incredible character that he would walk by those who the rest of society would ignore, and Jesus would stop and he would reach down to the lepers, to the women who had the bleeding for several years. He would reach into their lives and he would bring them back into society. Jesus is an undeniably attractive person. One of the aspects in which you see that, of course, is as the gospel has gone out in the world, that one of the interesting aspects is that whenever the gospel of Jesus Christ has come in contact with any other religion, that religion has always made room for Jesus. Have you noticed that? It has to do something with him. Because there is something about this man that is so commanding, you cannot deny him. But there's the problem. Because you see, although Jesus on the one hand is undeniably attractive, on the other hand, he made inescapable claims about himself. Notice with me, for instance, the cry of his critics in verse 41 and 42. At this, the Jews began to grumble about him because he said, "I am the bread that came down from heaven." They said, "Is this not Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How can he now say, 'I came down from heaven'?" Notice with me just a couple of the inescapable claims that Jesus makes, for instance, in this passage. Back in verse 32 and 33, he claims to be the bread of life. Jesus said to them, "I tell you the truth, it is not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." Now, friends, think about that a minute. What Jesus is saying is something like this. Not simply that he has come down into life to somehow enhance the lives of those who personally become acquainted with him. Nor is he saying that he is bringing a new philosophy, a new way of understanding life, that if people would listen to his new philosophy and new way of life, that would bring about a quality of life that would be distinctly improved from where they were at the moment. No, what he is saying is this, that in a very profound way, he is the source of life. I'm the bread of heaven. That somehow he is the point of life. Now you may at that point say, "Wait a minute, that is an audacious claim, an egotistical claim. How could anyone say that? Is it not perhaps, Michael, that you're reading into it that perhaps Jesus didn't quite mean that, or perhaps he slipped a little bit in his language as we sometimes do?" Well, notice how he responds. Verse 34, "Sir," they said, From now on, give us this bread. Then Jesus declared, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry. He who believes in me will never be thirsty. Jesus is saying something like this. You know, when you're on holiday and you see the sun going down, it's an idyllic moment. You're there on a campsite like we've been the last few days. We've been camping and you see the sun going down and suddenly there's a blaze of red and orange. And you're sitting there and as you're watching it go down, just suddenly for a moment there's just something in you that just feels, man, there's something beyond me. Or maybe you're there in your home alone. Maybe you feel desperately lonely. And in one of those moments, as you're just sitting there quietly, suddenly there's an ache in your heart that says, look, I need someone. Jesus is saying here, he is that something and someone that at those quiet moments we just begin to get a glimpse of. He's saying, I am the ultimate hunger in your heart. I'm the ultimate thirst that you long for. In those quiet moments when everything else is stripped away and suddenly in your heart you cry out for something, that is who I am. I'm the bread of life. Now what an audacious claim. If that wasn't enough, Jesus goes on to even make a greater claim as well. A bit later on, verse 40. He says, for my Father's will is that everyone who looks to the Son and believes in Him shall have eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Jesus is saying there that when we stand before God, when everything else is taken away, at the end of time, that my eternity will rest solely upon my relationship with Him. It is whether I am related to Him that will be the question. Not my life. Not my achievements. Not my family. Not even my sincerity. But Jesus is making a claim that what will matter at that moment, the only thing that will matter, is our relationship with Him, the Son. Now friends, you see the problem. On the one hand, Jesus is undeniably attractive, but on the other hand, he makes these inescapable claims. What do you do with that kind of a person? What do you do with Jesus? Historically, people have said that Jesus is the one individual you can never ignore. His life demands that we answer that question. His claims demand that we cannot simply leave them to one side. Really, we're only left with one of three possibilities. Either he is a liar and manipulator and charlatan on the level of a Hitler who is trying to somehow deceive people. However, that doesn't look likely when you look at the quality of his life and his compassion to others. Or he's a lunatic, maybe who has a degree of megalomania, who somehow thinks that he's God when he's not. But then how do you explain the miracles? Or, he must be the Lord that he claims to be. Whatever you do, you cannot simply ignore him. How does Jesus, or the passage before us, answer that question? Well, notice with me that this passage presents us with two answers. The first one is simply this, the fact of who he was. Why were these crowds there around him at this particular moment in time trying to make him king? Well, it was because he had fed the 5,000 from a few loaves and a few fishes. In other words, you see within the life of Jesus miracles and displays of power that in themselves answer the question of whether he's authentic or not. Now, friend, the Bible recognizes there have always been wonders in the world. There have always been miracles and miracle workers. The Bible acknowledges that. But what you find when you look into the life of Jesus is this. There are miracle workers and there is Jesus. There may be miracle workers that over here sometimes can do phenomenal things that you and I cannot explain. But when you look at the life of Jesus, He is in a category all of His own. He is a miracle worker with a big M that no one else is. And what you see there is this. How do you explain a man who walks on water? How do you explain a man who can raise the dead back to life? I love this story over a few chapters later in John chapter 9. It illustrates this, I think, very clearly. Jesus is walking through the streets on one occasion. He sees a man that from birth is blind. Evidently, the family cannot economically support him, so they've kicked him out on the streets. He will have to beg for the rest of his life, though it may be a very short life indeed. Jesus walks by this man, has compassion on him, and heals him. And then Jesus walks off. Before long, the crowds begin to notice there's something different about this man, and suddenly they recognize, you can see. How can you see? He begins to explain to them, this man named Jesus came and walked up to me and he healed me. And there begins to be a big celebration. Then suddenly someone sees a bit of a problem. It's on the Sabbath. Now, I don't know who made the rules at those days, but that wasn't what you were supposed to do on the Sabbath. That's against the rules, evidently, healing somebody from blindness. So they call in the theological big guns and they have a conference to decide what they should do with this man who's been healed from his blindness. And there's a big discussion, as you'll find there in chapter 9, as they go back and forth in their inquiries. Finally, they come out with their decision, verse 28. Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciples. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." Now, friends, I want you to wait. Just pause there for a minute and recognize the situation. Here are the theologically trained minds of that day. Here are the ones that if you have a question about God and about spiritual things, about divinity, about theology, you go and ask them. They are the experts, supposedly. And their answer is simply this. We don't know. We can't figure out what it is. Now, this blind man, he's never been to a synagogue. He's never been into the temple. He wouldn't have been allowed because he was unclean, and therefore he would have been excluded. The only actual religious training this man has ever actually gained is from listening to the snatched conversations of people walking by him. That's all he actually knows because he's been excluded. So he is utterly ignorant. But listen to his answer. The man answered, verse 30. Now this is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he has opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of the opening of the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. By the way, even with all our supposed technology today, we cannot give sight back to a man born blind. Do you hear what the man's saying? You claim to be clever. You don't know. Actually, you're utterly closed-minded. You claim to be here looking into the facts. You want to know the truth. The truth of the matter is you are denying them when they're right before your nose. You say you're a tolerant person. You admire a lot about Jesus. You like his teachings. You find them stimulating. But you can't accept his claims. You're not tolerant. You are utterly intolerant and refuse to listen to the truth. You see the fact of who he was. How could this man do these things if he were not God? And then there's also, very briefly, chapter 6, verse 45, the fact of the lives he changes. Jesus quotes there the prophet Isaiah when he says, it is written in the prophets, they will all be taught by God. Everyone who listens to the Father and learns from him comes to me. If you go back to that passage in Isaiah, you discover that what the prophet is saying, that as men and women and young people and boys and girls would come to Jesus, as the truth of the gospel would come into their lives would be liberated. The quality, the reality, the character of their lives would suddenly be liberated. And in one sense, what Jesus is saying is this. Do you want to know whether I am truly who I say I am? Then look at the people who come to me. Look at their lives. Do you find that as they come to me that their lives are distorted and destroyed and into bondage? Or do you find they find hope and purpose and strength? They're liberated in their hearts and lives. Which is it? The problem of the person of Jesus. The second problem the critics raise is the problem of Jesus' diagnosis of the problem, our hearts. That comes out, I suggest to you, in verse 52, when we read that the Jews began to argue sharply among themselves, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Now, in the passage, you'll remember that earlier, Jesus has just said that he has come down to be the living bread, and he's made an audacious claim, verse 51, that if anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever, and this bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Now, I suggest to you that the Jews at that time would have understood that Jesus was provocatively using the language of the temple. That somehow or another, though they didn't quite understand it, Jesus was claiming that in some unique way, he would be the ultimate sacrifice that would bring them ultimate life. Now, I suggest to you the crowd simply thought that was too dramatic, too negative. Why do we need this? We've been going to the temple. We've been doing our sacrifices. I live a good life. I'm a good Jew. Why do we need this? It really comes down to this question. What ultimately is wrong with my life? Interesting. Just pause there a minute and ask yourself, what is it that ultimately is wrong with your life? Some of us may be tempted to say, well, the real problem in my life is my circumstances. It's my job situation. It's the boss over me and the requirements he demands of me. And his personal skills are really quite lacking. That's my problem. If I had a different boss, my life would be so much better. Or you may say, it's my health problems. That's the ultimate problem in my life. If my health was better, if I didn't have these concerns, if I didn't have this prospect, everything would be great. I would be quite happy. Or you may say, it's the people in my life. It's my family, my husband or my wife, my children, or maybe my friends, wider. They don't appreciate me as they ought to. They don't treat me with the respect that they should treat me with. If simply those things were different, my life would be all right. Really what that's saying is, ultimately, something like this. That deep down in my heart, if you dig deep enough, you will find, ultimately, I am good. My problem is that my circumstances prevent that good from getting out and enjoying life. But here's the problem. Jesus taught that fundamentally, if you dig deep enough down in our hearts, you will find they are polluted and rotten and bad. And the problem is that that gets out all the time. That's the problem in life, according to Jesus. It's not our circumstances, it's our hearts. In fact, notice how he brings it out in the passage. He brings out a new understanding of ourselves. Verse 49, and also you'll note it is repeated again in verse 58. Jesus says this, your forefathers ate manna in the desert, yet they died. Let's go back to Sunday school for a minute, says Jesus. You remember the story of the Exodus, where God brought his people under Moses out of Egypt? He brought them into the desert. Do you remember what happened then, says Jesus? God fed them manna. In fact, in many ways, God really gave them everything. Think about it for a moment. You mothers will appreciate this. You know, you don't have to go out and do your weekly shopping, you know, and look at the budget. It's right outside the door every morning, your food. You don't even have to worry about it. You don't have to worry about clothes, and if you've got children with shoes, and you know how it is, about every 2 or 3 months you have to get new shoes, you don't have to worry about that either, because the shoes were constantly of good repair. You never had to replace them. You never had to replace your clothes in the desert. And if that wasn't enough, you had this lovely security system at night. You had this huge pillar of fire, so there was no thievery. And during the daytime, you didn't have to worry about it too much either, the hot blazing sun, because you had a huge pillar of cloud to give you a nice little shade to be under as well. It was a brilliant life. In fact, you could describe the desert in this way, that when the people of God went through the desert, they had miracles on tap. They never wanted. But let me ask you this. What did they do in the desert? What did they do? Someone tell me. Do you remember? They grumbled. They had everything. All the food they wanted. All the clothing they wanted. They had health. They had everything, miracles on tap, and what did they do? They grumbled. Do you see what Jesus is saying there? He's saying, do you get the point? If it was merely your circumstances that prevented you from enjoying life, then they would have been thrilled to bits in the desert. But even when God gave them everything, they still grumbled. Why? Because sin makes us ultimately, obsessively self-centered. Sin makes us always wanting to be at the center of our own little universe and world. Sin is never satisfied, but always wants more. And friends, don't you know that to be true in your life? Think about it a minute. How many times have you desperately wanted something? You sat there and thought, if I could just have that new TV, that new DVD, or if you're a young person, that new PC game, or if you're a girl, if I just had that new set of clothes, that everything would be great. And when you got it, what happened? You were happy for about 5 minutes, weren't you? And then what did you do? You began to grumble about something else. You see, if it was just the circumstances, that wouldn't happen, says Jesus. No, the problem is far more fundamental and deep down. Our problem is we need a new heart. And ultimately, what Jesus is claiming there in verses 53 to 58 is that that is precisely what he has come into the world to do. He says, look, I have come into this world to be the ultimate sacrifice. I've come into the world to be what you can never be. I'm going to live a perfect life. I am not going to grumble. And I have come into the world that at the end of my life, what I'm going to do is pay the price for all your failures to live as you ought to live. And to go to the cross and to be the ultimate sacrifice to give you a new life. You see, he's using vivid language in order to press home the point that we can never cure ourselves. What we need is a radical new beginning that only Jesus can bring about. So the problem of the person of Jesus, the problem of the diagnosis of Jesus, and the problem as we close of the promise of Jesus. That comes out really in verse 60 when we read this. On hearing it, Many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" You can feel that, can't you? John, who writes this gospel, he lived in a very multi-faith society. The early world in the first century was a very multi-faith society. And John recognized that many people found this a very difficult, hard teaching to listen to, very much like in our own day. I mean, I suggest if Jesus were to say this today, that probably somebody would come along and say, "Well, Jesus, thank you very much. I find your teachings incredibly interesting. But surely you can't be saying that Islam doesn't have a little bit to teach us. And what about Buddhism? Jesus, your words are suggesting that somehow exclusively you're the only way." That's not very PC. Interestingly enough, Jesus seems to recognize the tenor of this argument. So we go on in verse 61 and we read this. Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, "Does this offend you? What then if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? Do you think this is difficult that I say that I am exclusively the one that you must come to as the ultimate sacrifice? What are you going to do when I am ascended to the Father's right hand to be the Lord of glory?" Why is Jesus really the only way? Friends, the answer is very simple. Because the gospel is about good news, not good advice. You see, let me open that up for you. Every other religion, if I can put it this way, is ultimately about good advice. Whether that is the seven stages of enlightenment in Buddhism, whether it's the five pillars of Islam, in the end, every other religion comes alongside you and it says something like this. If you diligently listen to these teachings or this enlightenment, and if you will in your own life begin to practice this, and if you will follow this good advice and go do this, then in the end you will be all right. You will get to heaven or nirvana or whatever, paradise. So ultimately what it comes down to is that you must follow the good advice. The problem is, if we're honest, none of us completely follow the good advice, do we? We all fail. Sometimes, sadly, we can think of the gospel in that way. And we can even think of the teachings of Jesus rather in that category as well. And we can think that what the gospel does is come alongside to us and say this: if you live your life this way, you'll be all right. By the way, that's not what the gospel teaches. Because all of us will fail. The gospel is not good advice, it's good news. And it's good news in this respect, that the gospel tells us that what you and I could never do, Jesus did for us. That the life that you and I can never live because we are all failed and we are all flawed, Jesus lived and never failed and was never flawed. That the ultimate requirement that is necessary for us to be accepted by God, which none of us can ever achieve because we all fall short, He achieved. And the gospel comes to us and says this: not that you can get your life better by following the good advice, but if you will trust in the only one in all of history who actually did it and accomplished it and is now in heaven as a validation of the fact that He alone did it, if you put your trust in Him as your substitute, then you will be accepted. Not on your merits, but on His. And ultimately, that's why Jesus is the only way. Because Muhammad didn't live a perfect life. He gave good advice. Buddha didn't live a perfect life. He gave good advice. Joseph Smith, the Mormon, didn't live a perfect life. He gave good advice. And the problem is that you and I do not need good advice. We need good news. that says there is one who lived a perfect life on my behalf and died a perfect death for my sins. And He alone can make me acceptable to God. The problem of Jesus. Jesus and His critics. The problem of the person of Jesus. Well, the answer is simply look at who He was. Look at the lives of those who come to Him. The problem of the diagnosis of Jesus. But Jesus opens up to us here in this passage that if we just for a moment stop and look more deeply into our lives, we'll see that it's not just our circumstances, but our hearts that need help. And ultimately, only one man came to die for those hearts. And the problem of the promise of hope, not that it gives us good advice, but good news, that every single one of us today can take hold of and find new hope and life in.